you know, quite rightly, obviously, number 10, there's a police presence. So people in the police were aware that, or should have been aware that, you know, something was going on in the back garden.
While people were dying and while people were unable to attend funerals, for him to be holding parties and agreeing to parties to be held when he made the rules is fairly immoral.
The public mood here is one of outrage at the moment, but experts say what Boris Johnson desperately needs now is not public support, but the backing of his own party members to avoid a leadership challenge. Saidpur is up, London.
Yemeni health workers have staged a demonstration inside the Ministry of Health in Yemen's capital Sana'a to warn that over 300 health facilities are on the verge of collapse due to the severe fuel shortage. They slammed the continued detention of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The health sector is suffering greatly due to the lack of fuel, as health officials suffer from a shortage in electrical power generations to save the lives of thousands of patients. Intensive care units, oxygen factories, operation rooms, emergency rooms and other divisions will stop, and this is a crime against the Yemeni people. Unfortunately, the international community remains silent about what is happening. The United Nations has failed to fulfill its duties.
The Ministry of Health has called on the international community to step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels and save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients who may lose their lives as a result of the Saudi blockade on the country.
Banning the entry of fuel ships and piracy on Yemeni oil ships lead to a health catastrophe, as hospitals and health centers are in constant need of fuel. The interruption means that health services will stop working. Some patients come from other governorates to get treatment in Sana'a, such as cancer patients, and the fuel crisis will make their transportation even more difficult. We warn of an imminent health disaster and call on the international community to do its part to save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children.
Recently, the member of Yemen's negotiating delegation, Abdul Malik al-Hajri, passed away of kidney failure as he could not travel abroad for treatment due to the continued closure of Sana'a International Airport that comes as Saudi Arabia and its allies have imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015.
The lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, are in danger amid the absence of essential healthcare services. Unfortunately, the inaction of the international community towards the catastrophic situation in Yemen is emboldening the Saudi-led coalition to further continue its crimes in the war-ravaged country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Omani Foreign Minister Badr al-Busaidi met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. The two sides discussed bilateral relations and recent regional developments. During the talks, Assad referred to both countries' mutual understanding of regional issues, asserting that Arabs need to conduct realistic dialogue and set up necessary bases for political relations among each other. He stressed that developments in the Arab world require a change of their political approach. For his part, Busaidi conveyed to Assad greetings of the Omani Sultan, underlining Syria's strong and brave stances in facing regional challenges.
We look forward to strengthening our economic, trade and political relations. I discussed in detail such relations with my Syrian counterpart. There are efforts made by many countries currently to bring Arabs together, correct mistakes of the past and adopt a more futuristic vision for Arab cooperation in order to overcome the past.
For his part, Syrian Foreign Minister underlined the significance of collaboration with Oman for bringing Arabs together.
The meeting was an opportunity to discuss joint Arab action and solidarity, as well as establishing the best relations among Arab states in order to correct previous mistakes and build the future. Syria and Oman formed together a force for underlining the importance of a united Arab stance to overcome challenges facing our countries and peoples.
Oman has been working for years on alleviating tension between Arab countries, mainly with regards to Syria. He arrived in Damascus coming from Kuwait, where Arab foreign ministers were meeting. The significance of Oman's strategy towards Syria is that it did not sever its ties, as many Arab countries did during the crisis.
The visit comes as Arab countries are gradually restoring relations with Syria following the victory of the country's government against terror. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Israeli forces have escalated their arrest campaigns throughout the occupied territories, detaining dozens of Palestinians in raids across the occupied West Bank early Monday. The Palestinian Prisoner Society revealed that the arrests were made mainly in Ain al-Sultan camp in Ariha, also known as Jericho, and Al-Jalazon refugee camp in Ramallah, as well as in a number of villages west of the city. The society accused Israel of trying to find different excuses to raid Palestinian areas. This time, the Israeli army announced that its forces operating in the West Bank were exposed to fire more than once by Palestinian resistance fighters.
The reasons behind arresting Palestinians this time are many and different. And the goal is to drain the energy of the Palestinian people, in which they won't resist Israel, the occupation. The Israeli tries through detention to convince the people that there is no way to achieve victory.
Israeli forces continue to storm Palestinian villages and cities on a daily basis under the excuse of arresting Palestinian activists. In the village of Qatani, northwest occupied Al-Quds, two Palestinians were shot and seriously wounded before they were detained.
These campaigns are part of Israeli oppression that aims at breaking the Palestinian resistance to occupation, but they will not succeed. And in my opinion, all these arrests reflect the crisis of the Israeli system that does not understand that Palestinians will never give up.
Palestinians warn that Israel's escalated crackdown against the activists and the use of excessive force is meant to fight the Palestinian resistance. They see the operations as a failed attempt to intimidate the youth into giving up resistance. Israel holds thousands of Palestinians, including women and minors, in jail. Israel intensifies its arrest campaigns against Palestinians under the pretext of a policy known as mowing the lawn, which is aimed at re-arresting Palestinian activists to prevent any forms of resistance. Experts say these detentions remain as part of Tel Aviv's perpetual war against the Palestinians. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
In honor of tens of athletes and sporting clubs, the Global Campaign to Return to Palestine held the International Forum to honor anti-normalization athletes under the slogan Al-Quds Golden Medal in the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
We are honoring these champions from Iran and different Arab countries because they refuse to play against an Israeli player because they don't recognize the so-called Israel. They paid a heavy price for that. We look at them as heroes.
Fathi Nourin, an Algerian and world champion who pulled out of four different competitions after finding out he would compete with an Israeli competitor, was punished by the International Judo Federation, which withdrew his Olympics accreditation. He noted that nothing is more significant than Palestine.
For us as athletes in Algeria, nothing is more valuable than the Palestinian cause, which is the cause of all Arabs and Muslims. And we are in solidarity with them and back them in any way we can. We have the chance to send a message to the world and raise awareness through sports about the Israeli terrorism, since the Israelis have been trying to win recognition through sports competitions, and we can, through sports, show the truth.
The athletes who were honored through their matches in international and regional tournaments to protest the presence of Israeli players or teams. Two chess players also had their share of a gold medal. So did 14-year-old Mauritanian Mohammed Abdulrahman.
There was like three people that qualified from Africa, and I qualified. And during that tournament, it was the last round, I played against this Israeli guy, and I just didn't play since it's a common gesture, and I stand with Palestine.
The Global Campaign to Return to Palestine stressed that they wanted to launch this initiative to show that these athletes who paid a price, whether being dismissed from international tournaments or deprived of important medals and valuable prizes, have won people's respect for their stance in defense of Palestine and the culture of resistance.
These athletes said they decided to rescind an international competition and prize if it meant recognizing Israeli occupation and apartheid state. Yet little did they know that by so doing, they became champions for millions of hearts across the Arab and Muslim worlds. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
What often passes for cultured Parisian cool has been exposed as deadly indifference to suffering humanity following the death of René Robert, a famous photographer of flamenco music. The 85-year-old fainted while on a walk in one of the most crowded areas of Paris. He couldn't get up and then tragically died of hypothermia after being ignored for 9 hours. The death has shocked France and has shamed the capital city in news worldwide. Robert died likely because people assumed he was just another street person in a fabulously rich city where homelessness is somehow a common sight. The person who finally checked on Robert was a homeless person who probably knew all too well the indifference of Paris to people sleeping rough, even in winter.
We keep repeating the same things. Everyone needs access to a life with dignity. We ask for structural reforms which will have real impact on the lives of people living in precarious existence. There has been a disengagement from France regarding the basic social minimums required in life.
Officially, around 6,000 people die on the streets of France each year, but NGOs say the real number is closer to 3,000 people. Refugees, mostly from countries hit by Western military intervention, die out of sight and without identification in tents, pushed into unseen and unlivable corners of the country.
We consider the question of housing to be a vital effort we need to make. We are asking for the basic recognition that everyone needs a roof over their heads. We're asking all the candidates in this spring's election to recognize that a state must take care of people.
Annual budget cuts during the age of austerity have pushed even more poor and mentally ill people into the streets, with evictions exploding so much the government refuses to publish the data anymore. Paris is the most population-dense city in the Western world, but government housing policy favors landlords and not renters. None of these government policy choices really explains the passing of René Robert, but many hope his needless death can change France's indifference towards the plight of those living on the streets. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Forty-three years ago, millions of Iranians flocked to Tehran's Mehrabad airport to welcome the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, back to the country. After 14 years of exile, the historic day was a milestone that put an end to centuries of monarchy in Iran. Ever since, Iranians have celebrated the occasion every year for 10 days. The event starts on the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's homecoming and culminates on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This period is called Dehe-i Fajr, or the 10-day dawn. As with every year, the ceremonies began with a visit by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to Imam Khomeini's mausoleum. The mausoleum also hosted state officials and people from all walks of life to mark the occasion.
Like every year, we gather today in this holy place to pay respect to Imam Khomeini, a man who changed the course of history in our country and established a political system that respects our beliefs as Muslims.
Today is an important day for us. We, the new generation, were not present those days, but we participate in this ceremony to learn about the personality of Imam Khomeini.
The Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini, who spent some 14 years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately led to the toppling of former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S.
During the Shah period, other countries like the U.S. made decisions for us. Iran was a U.S. colony. They were in our country to plunder our oil and other resources.
We lost many of our beloved ones for the sake of the Islamic Republic,
By celebrating the event, we seek to say no to foreign interference in our country. We still stick to those ideals, no matter how much pressure and sanctions the U.S. imposes on our nation.
Less than 2 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians took part in a referendum, where more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic as a new political system.
To Iranians, the 10-day dawn is reminiscent of their struggle for independence, a legacy that they're not willing to give up on, even if it means they have to endure U.S. sanctions. Now, one of the major goals of holding such massive celebrations is to pass on these messages to new generations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Islamic Revolution versus Modern Era of Ignorance. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are in the 10 days dawn, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The victory of the Islamic Revolution was a new voice and a new discourse across the world. The father of the revolution, late Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, roared against the modern Jahiliya, that is the era of ignorance, engulfing every aspect of government and daily life of the people. Jahiliya does not only mean ignorance. It rather means the era in which carnal desires overcome every affair in society and lead the individual and society to disobeying God's commands. The main Jahiliya took place in Hejaz, that is the Arabian Peninsula, preceding the prophethood of the Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. At that time, people had turned their back to the divine teachings of the previous prophets and insisted on idolatry and illogical tribal beliefs and customs. Humanity and ethics were in their nether, while immorality, adamancy, tribal and group, fanaticism, haughtiness, self-conceit, disturbing others, violence, humiliation of women and girls, and all sorts of vices were rampant. A father would boast of bearing his daughter alive. At this time, God sent his prophet Muhammad Mustafa, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Verse 2 of chapter Jum'ah of the Noble Quran reads in this regard, "It is God who sent to the unlettered people an apostle from among themselves to recite to them his signs, to purify them, and to teach them the book and wisdom. While earlier they had indeed been in manifest error. The Prophet of Islam created a government which was based on affection and love of fellow humans. He returned human dignity to people, especially women. However, Jahiliyyah is not restricted to the time of 14 centuries ago. Whenever human communities are deviated from the logical spiritual values, they have in fact indulged in Jahiliyyah, no matter if they deny it." 1400s had passed since the great revolution of the Prophet of Islam, and the world had been plunged in diverse form of jahiliya. Women had become playthings and the tools of pleasure for men. Bullies and oppressors had become the rulers of the world, and the poor and the weak had no chance of living in dignity and freedom. As in Iran, the Pahlavi royal family was ruling in full reverie and luxury, while countless cities and villages were deprived of their very necessities. The Shah claimed to be Muslim, whereas he had been installed by the British and supported by the Americans. He was absolutely dependent on the West, and the motto of his kingdom was to become Western from the head to the toe. The number of bars, brothels, discos, and centers of immorality was higher than libraries. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says, "There was propaganda to lead the people to immorality, promiscuity, and lechery. Even in the poor and backward regions, the places where people were in need of their first things, immorality and promiscuity were provided in a way. This was mainly intensified in places of the youth like universities and garrisons to busy and corrupt the generation. When the youth are corrupt, there will be no nation and no resistance will be seen." During the Pahlavi rule, the treasury of the country only belonged to the Shah, as if it were his personal account. Thus, he would generously spend to the American and British organizations and institutes to curry favor with his Western masters. Extravagant spending for royal ceremonies and purchase of many villas and apartments in the US and Europe were just part of the squandering of national money by the Shah and his family. Suddenly, a descendant of the Prophet of Islam, Ruhollah Musavi Khomeini, staged his unmatched revolution and said that the Shah should go and an Islamic government with people's votes should replace it. The Imam, in his first public speech, likened Muhammad Reza Shah rule to that of the Umayyad regime and Yazid. He asked people to be vigilant and advised the Shah to give up servility to the Western and Eastern colonialist and the usurper-fabricated regime of Israel. These fiery words not only didn't affect the tyrannical Shah, but also he suppressed the people in cold blood. Many young people were martyred in demonstrations in the cities, but the flames of the revolution swept across the country. Imam Khomeini guided the people from exile, and the Shah had to flee the country scandalously. The Imam returned home from exile, and the Islamic Revolution triumphed despite the enemies of Islam and Iran. In less than 2 months after this victory, the Islamic Republic system of government was established with people's massive turnout. In other words, over 90% of the people took to the ballot boxes and 98.2% of the population voted to the Islamic Republic. The ideas of Imam Khomeini had their roots in the Quran and the instructions of Prophet Muhammad and his infallible progeny, blessings of God upon them. The Imam was very highly charismatic and, like the divine prophets, staged his uprising for promotion of God's commands. He put forward religious popular rule as the method of Islamic rule in the modern world. His ideology strongly challenged Western humanism and Eastern socialism as the two main powers of the time. The Islamic Revolution has firmly stood against deviant currents and new narratives from Islam, such as Wahhabism and American Islam, on the one hand, and the Western culture on the other hand. The modern Jahiliya, or era of ignorance, however, still tries to keep its clutches on the entire world by hook or by crook. Today, those governments which masquerade as the flag bearers of development and progress are indeed annihilating democracy, human rights, and the beliefs of dependent nations all over the world. Palestine has been occupied by the child-killing Israeli regime for over 7 decades. This happens in utter silence of the international organizations and bodies, particularly the United Nations, whose very existence is to defend the defenseless and support the weak in the world. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "What the political apparatuses are propagating today is the very Jahiliya which the Prophet of Islam was sent to remove it from the human life. The signs of that very Jahiliya can be seen today in the world in the prevalent corrupt Western civilization. The same injustice, the same discrimination, the same overlooking the human dignity, the same bolding of sexual issues and sexual needs. One of the signs of the first Jahiliya is the female display of phyny. Today, one of the main displays of the Western civilization is this very display. This is the same Jahiliya, but the Jahiliya which has managed to get equipped with the weapon of modern propaganda to conceal realities from people's eyes. We Muslims should understand these. We should know these."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the standoff between the U.S. and NATO with Russia over Ukraine, there seems to be a key development that changes the dynamics. Now Ukraine has come out and said that the U.S. in particular is hyping the situation and has elevated to a war scenario. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. is taking a more aggressive stance against Russia and whether the U.S. reluctance to not meet Russia's security demands will end up in a war or not.
Ukraine, a country in Eastern Europe, making the headlines these days as it remains a source of friction between its neighbor Russia and backers in the US-led NATO alliance. Corporate media have been trying to portray Russia as an aggressor, bombarding their audience with reports on the country's troop deployment at the border, its military drills, as well as moving blood supplies to Ukraine. can the international community fall into yet another war trap in a scenario set by the West on a likely Russian invasion of Ukraine? But the question is, given the US-led NATO's eastward expansion and transfer of their lethal weapons and troops bases in Eastern Europe, which one is the real aggressor, NATO or Russia?
When the Soviet Union fell and the Warsaw Pact had already been ended, since then NATO has added 14 more countries, and nearly all of them are countries that were either republics of the Soviet Union or allies of the Soviet Union.
Ukraine is simply a pawn on the Western chessboard. The U.S. has already sent several consignments of weapons as part of a multi-million dollar security aid to Ukraine while planning more troop deployment. America's allies, Britain, France, and others, have also put their forces on alert. The massive propaganda has even prompted the Ukrainian leader to urge his Western counterparts to avoid stirring panic over a Russia invasion. The West claims Russia is building up troops at the border to invade Ukraine. Moscow denies any such plan, saying its troop mobilization is simply defensive. It says the buildup also aims to counter NATO aggression. The military alliance has conducted several war games near Russian borders, three of them jointly with Ukraine, which is not even a member of the military alliance. So, what's the real game plan? Analysts believe the U.S. wants to integrate Ukraine into the American empire by granting it a NATO membership, a message hidden in Washington's response to Moscow's security proposals.
This makes the Russians see red spots before their eyes, the same way as any talk of Mexico, say, joining a Chinese military alliance would make them freak out in Washington. It's not a difficult problem.
Russia is seeking to reassert its place in the international arena, and its proposals for a diplomatic resolution to the Ukraine standoff seem reasonable. A possible military conflict between the European Union and Russia would entail massive human losses and economic harms. Undoubtedly, Russia has grown increasingly concerned about its security because of Western weapons and forces deployed to its doorstep. The corporate media have played a vital part in fueling tensions, and the U.S., that has waged numerous wars overseas, knows very well how dangerous provoking a war with Russia will be.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, representative to the U.N. from the Schiller Institute, Richard Black, joins us from Hackensack, New Jersey. We also have radio host, journalist, and political activist Don DeBar, who joins us from Ossining, New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Don DeBar, first to you. You have the U.S. pretty familiar with the stance of the U.S. at this point, very pro-militaristic in nature, 8,500 troops on heightened alert. They have told Ukraine, we're going to keep giving you arms. They just delivered I don't know how many hundreds of tons of arms based on the latest report. And then you had the Ukrainian pro-war president that I'm going to take on Russia changing stance. Of which his latest quote was, he said, stop creating panic. And he said, we don't need this panic. What is going on here? Is there a change of stance from the Ukrainian president?
It's hard to parse what things are real and what things are for public consumption, because there's a great deal of both moving parts in play right now. you have a pronouncement from Lukashenko, about, he's basically playing the same role that the Ukrainian president is playing, let me at him, hold me back, in other words, you have two paper tiger, mad dogs that are your proxy, sort of like a 21st century version of Yugoslavia and Albania when the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China would have a public dispute. These would be their proxies. First, in terms of all the things that are going on, who's their hostilities and what's going on. There are satellites, networks in the possession of both sides of this that they've been using for 50 years now. They know exactly who has what resources deployed where. So you have a discussion, for example, where people say, okay, well, if they're going to put the troop, U.S. and NATO are going to put troops in Ukraine, and they're going to try to foment color revolutions, quote unquote, in Belarus and Kazakhstan, and you look at a map and it starts to look like Operation Barbarossa, because that's true, by the way. You look at a map of the fullest extent of the Nazi invasion in the early 1940s and where NATO is now and where they're trying to go, they'd be starting Hitler's invasion from the front lines instead of from Germany, which is the Russian strategists are well aware of this. Uh-huh. So people say, well, suppose they put resources in Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua,
right,
and then the United States, there's a huge outcry, we will not allow that to be severe consequences. Well, and then you have from Lavrov and Putin a statement that we are now reaching deeper relations, economic, social, political, and military, vague. So that stuff is for public consumption. The United States knows exactly where every piece of Russian and Chinese military equipment on the planet is, as do they know where every piece of NATO, et cetera. So there's a real game that's going on between the two militaries and intelligence agencies and right. The deep government in this case, and then there's this TV show we're watching. It's hard to parse which is which.
But one of the things that Richard Black, Don DeBar said there is the fact that how Ukraine can be, in a sense, a proxy for the U.S. I mean, we know that there was a color revolution that happened in Ukraine, but we're looking at how just in the past days the Ukrainian president has changed stance. Another one of his quotes, Ukraine's stability is of great significance. And he said U.S. is panic triggering alerts are placing a heavy burden on the economy. It seems like there's a diversion. Do you think there is one?
Yes, it is the case that President Zelensky has made the point repeatedly in the last days that certain forces in the West, typified by CNN, Truss of Britain, and others, are talking about an imminent invasion of Ukraine by Russia, which does not exist. The Ukrainian leadership keeps saying it does not exist. The Russian leadership has said it does not exist. So something very nasty and dangerous is coming out from what we had identified since the days of President Eisenhower as the military-industrial complex in the West. Today, Britain calls itself Global Britain and is pushing the pouring of weapons into Ukraine like mad. But step back a second. First of all, NATO became obsolete in 1991 when the Soviet Union disbanded. And what is required, the solution, is a new security architecture involving all of Europe, based on the principles of the Treaty of Westphalia of 1648, which ended massive religious warfare in Europe. The principle of diplomacy in a seemingly intractable situation is nations acting for the benefit of the other. I don't believe that President Biden wants a war with Russia. The American people don't want a war with Russia. And it's imperative that the United States...
What does he want then? What does he want when you say that? When you say Biden doesn't want a war with Russia, what does he want? Because it sure smells like one.
Not necessarily. If you look at the transcripts and the videos, the media continually attempts to goad him make provocative statements against Russia, and he keeps saying, we'll see a little bit, I'm not sure. I want to that there are significant forces in the United States, typified by former Ambassador Matlock to Russia, former Ambassador Chas Freeman to Saudi Arabia, former CIA Chief Graham Fuller in Afghanistan, who have all been calling very, very loudly and vociferously for a pullback of the U.S. offensive against Russia and calling for accepting the very recent proposals of the Russian Federation. Similarly, in Europe, many, many, many nations and leaders are saying this has to be slowed down.
Okay, let's get into that. I was going to get into that a little bit later, but Don DeBar, you had this interesting document which the U.S. decided not to release the details. It's very confusing as to the way that the U.S. approached this, not wanting to make it public, and for Russia to make parts of it public. But basically, I don't know if you saw that press conference where you had the U.S. Secretary of State presenting this document and saying, we're offering Russia a roadmap. But it sounded like it was a roadmap for the U.S. and not for Russia, because none of Russia's demands were met. But, of course, he didn't want to come out and say that, Anthony Blinken. At the same time, he was very vociferous when it came to how much weapons they're giving Ukraine, how their allies, U.S. allies in the Baltic states, for example, that are going to be getting more weapons. It's almost as if the U.S. had the gun down Russia's throat, saying, if you don't follow what we are proposing, then this is what you're going to get. Did you get that impression?
Well, I saw the press conference. What he delivered was a reply document from the United States. There was one also that came from NATO. There were reply documents to a pair of proposals, again, one to the United States and one to NATO, that Russia delivered on December 17th of this past year. And it wasn't a roadmap. He used the word roadmap here, from Blinken's mouth. I'm thinking of this image from the Johnny Carson show when they used to say a fake commercial, meet at the fork of the road, and there'd be an actual fork and then a bunch of squiggly lines behind it, a map that was useless to anyone trying to go anywhere. Russia laid out very plainly what the concerns are that they have, that they would like to negotiate a settlement, basically a global settlement with the United States and NATO, that you promise not to move your alliance up to our doorstep, in fact, not to even take military equipment into Eastern Germany at that time, East Germany, let alone into the Warsaw Pact countries, Poland, Czechoslovakia, the whole lot of them, Romania, Bulgaria. And so what happened instead was not only did they take most of the, and this was a point for Blinken, that someone misspoke on a TV show on RT and said practically all instead of saying most, but almost every member of the Warsaw Pact is now a member of NATO, along with the three Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, and some other Soviet republics. And then on top of that, you had an attempted coup in each of Belarus and Kazakhstan that are clearly tied to the CIA. I mean, there's been millions, and there was $5 billion, according to Victoria Nuland from the U.S. State Department, Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, that was spent in the lead up to the Maidan coup, basically developing the communications infrastructure, including three TV stations that were used during the. This kind of thing has been going on in all of the old Soviet republics around Russia and in East Europe, and so Russia is seeing this, and they're seeing the troops that they fought when Germany invaded, rolling in with being greeted by the locals, realizing the troops are being placed there for them.
Well, what's interesting about Richard Black, is the fact that in some cases we're looking at a Europe that has been somewhat conspicuously absent from the talks. I mean, remember the talks the week before where you had Wendy Sherman doing the negotiations with the Russian envoy at that point, and then there were news that it was the U.S. that was making the bidding for Europe, but not all European countries are on board. Why is it that Europe is not present, not actively present, when it comes to the talks?
Well, it is absolutely the case. case that there's a process that has emerged in Europe in which within many of NATO countries, the answer to war with Russia over Ukraine is absolutely no. Croatia has said we will not send troops. The Hungarian foreign minister is saying we need to negotiate long-term energy deals with Russia. Macron just had a long conversation yesterday with President Putin. President Putin just had a seminar with leading Italian industrialists earlier in the week, and a new one is being set up between German industrialists who want peace with Russia, a new video conference with President Putin. So in fact, it is the case that Blinken is lying, that there is a great deal of light between the positions of the nations of Europe and the United States, and Europe knows that it will go up in a nuclear holocaust, since it is the host to American nuclear weapons, if there's a war between, and let us be clear, we're talking about the possibility of a nuclear war between the United States and Russia. That's what's at stake here. And as I said earlier, I don't believe the U.S. Commander-in-Chief, this is my view, the Schiller Institute's view, it's not our view that the President, the Commander-in-Chief, President Biden, wants a nuclear war with Russia, and that's what's at stake.
Mm-hmm. Well, given that that's what's at stake, maybe that's why you're having these Eastern Ukraine talks, as it's called, Donbas, in which Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France are voicing support for what it seems like a ceasefire, maintaining a ceasefire.
Yeah.
And this kind of is like the negotiations that were called the Normandy talks. Maybe you can take us back. It sounds an awful lot like the year 2014 when you had the Ukraine crisis in a sense, break out, and then there were these talks. What were the Normandy talks? Are they feasible? Are those talks feasible to lay groundwork for a ceasefire? This will be for Donbas. Go ahead, Donbas. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Get back to you.
You say Normandy. There's actually an agreement, the Minsk agreements. And the Minsk agreement was, in essence, the key parts of it, that the Eastern Ukraine republics, particularly, I believe, Donetsk and Lugansk, I don't remember if the third one was part of the agreement as to this part of the deal, they would become autonomous within, you know, the state of Ukraine. They would be autonomous governments, and this would resolve the contradiction between Kiev and the people that live in the east, in essence, because the domestic political situation in Ukraine is fragmented. It has been for, you know, a very long time. The people in the east are ethnic Russians. The people in the west are a composite of ethnic Poles, Lithuanians, you know, and others from, you know, more or less Western Europe. You have the whole, you know, historic schism between the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic world. Kind of that's a fracture line also that runs right through it. And the cultures that have evolved over many years. And by the way, most of Ukraine in both of those spheres, up until the last century for sure or so, were part of Russia for centuries. And so there are many contradictions on the ground that represent political constituencencies. For example, that Zelensky has to deal with. Like, Zelensky came in, he was elected as a peacemaker, he was going to resolve this dispute between the West and the East, and he got elected despite that fact, not because of it, in the West, because he was a TV star, and I think that's why he was chosen as a candidate. Once mm-hmm. he got in, he has a balancing act with these constituencies on the ground,
sure.
and there is a very strong fascist element that has a very strong shock troop on the ground constituent that he has to deal with, and the United States is using that as sort of a forward guard to intimidate Russia, and it's really dangerous the way that that's playing out. I'm just going to go to one last little point. In the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, as it's called here, which is actually because the U.S. put missiles in Turkey in 1961, that when Kennedy did that, everybody involved, Robert McNamara, Fidel Castro, Khrushchev in his memoirs, tell you that it was sheer luck that we didn't have nuclear war. We're playing now, it literally, Russian roulette, firing another shot and hoping the chamber is empty.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if Joe Biden, no matter what his intentions are, is up to it the way that John Kennedy was. And that's what we're gambling with right now.
Gambling. Russian roulette. Richard Black. Provocations, this is very similar in a sense to what the U.S. is doing when it comes to the South China Sea and the way it's provoking China. I'm not too sure what foreign policy structure or plans the U.S. has by being involved in these big, what looks like adventures. Maybe you can tell us what is going on here. Because, you know, Russia and China, obviously these are big powers.
I think you probably know the answer to the question, which is that there's a faction in the Republican and Democratic Party and in the U.S. media as a whole which wants the United States to be the world hegemon. And in the West, there's a very deep, deep global financial crisis. Hyperinflation is out of control. The debt structure in the entire West is a disaster. And what they're proposing as a solution is continued massive hyperinflation to keep the bubble going and the Green New Deal to get the world, including Iran, to get out of fossil fuels and out of nuclear. China is not accepting this. Russia is not accepting this. So China and Russia are both targets of this war faction in the West, which is proceeding out of desperation. At the same time, I would make the point that a new strategic element in the world as a whole is this unique collaboration now between China and Russia. They are inseparable from the standpoint of economic policy, development policy, strategic policy, and therefore, in the West, those who would push the West towards war may be facing war against Russia and China simultaneously, and this hopefully will function as a wise deterrent.
Okay, Don DeBar, my last question to you quickly, if you can. The Chinese ambassador to the U.S. issued a warning, possible military conflict over Taiwan. So my question, what are the chances of the U.S. being involved in a military confrontation with China compared to one with Russia?
He wants Jimmy the Greek, not me. Listen, that faction that Richard speaks of, by the way, exists. The faction is called Congress, the White House, Langley, the Pentagon, the Supreme Court, every other institution of power that the United States has, and the media. That is the war faction in this thing, the one that wants hegemony. There does not seem to be a constituency outside of the political forces organized around Trump and maybe somewhat around Sanders that are even willing to consider the possibility of a multipolar world rather than this hegemonic one that they've been striving for certainly since 1991. But 1991 is really a product of the striving before that.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Don DeBar, journalist and political activist there, and a radio host from
Asana.
Richard Black, I'm sorry we're fresh out of time. Representative to the UN from the Schiller Institute, who spoke to us from Hackensack, New Jersey. We'll bring you on for another program, I'm sure. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitafoy and the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.